Trying to flip things around by asking, well, what do we owe to society? Or even trying to talk about our debt to nature or some other manifestation of the cosmos is a false solution. Really just a desperate scramble to salvage something from the very moral logic that has severed us from the cosmos to begin with. In fact, it's, if anything, the culmination of the process brought to a point of veritable dementia, since it's premised on the assumption that we're so absolutely thoroughly disentangled from the world that we can just toss all other human beings, or all other living creatures even, or the cosmos, in a sack and then start negotiating with them. It's hardly surprising that the end result, historically, is to see our life itself as something we hold on false premises, alone long since overdue, and therefore to see existence itself as criminal. Insofar as there's a real crime here, though, it's a fraud. The very premise is fraudulent. What could possibly be more presumptuous or more ridiculous than to think it would be possible to negotiate with the grounds of one's existence? Of course it isn't. Insofar as it is indeed possible to come into any sort of relation with the absolute, we're confronting a principle that exists outside of time, or human-scale time, entirely. Therefore, as medieval theologians correctly recognized, when dealing with the absolute, there can be no such thing as debt. Conclusion. Perhaps the world really does owe you a living. Much of the existing literature on credit and banking, when it turns to the kind of larger historical questions treated in this book, strikes me as little more than special pleading. True, earlier figures like Adam Smith and David Ricardo were suspicious of credit systems, but already by the mid-19th century, economists who concerned themselves with such matters were largely in the business of trying to demonstrate that despite appearances, the banking system really was profoundly democratic. One of the more common arguments was that it was really a way of funneling resources from the idle rich, who, too unimaginative to do the work of investing their own money, entrusted it to others, to the industrious poor, who had the energy and initiative to produce new wealth. This justified the existence of banks, but it also strengthened the hand of populists who demanded easy money policies, protections for debtors, and so on. Since, if times were rough, why should the industrious poor, the farmers and artisans and small businessmen, be the ones to suffer? This gave rise to a second line of argument, that no doubt the rich were the major creditors in the ancient world, but now the situation has been reversed. So Ludwig von Mises, writing in the 1930s, around the time when Keynes was calling for the euthanasia of the rentier, quote,
"Public opinion has always been biased against creditors. It identifies creditors with the idle rich and debtors with the industrious poor. It abhors the former as ruthless exploiters and pities the latter as innocent victims of oppression. It considers government action designed to curtail the claims of the creditors as measures extremely beneficial to the immense majority at the expense of a small minority of hard-boiled usurers. It did not notice at all that 19th-century capitalist innovations have wholly changed the composition of the classes of creditors and debtors. In the days of Solon the Athenian, of ancient Rome's agrarian laws, and of the Middle Ages, the creditors were by and large the rich and the debtors the poor. But in this age of bonds and debentures, mortgage banks, saving banks, life insurance policies, and social security benefits, the masses of people with more moderate income are rather themselves creditors."
Unquote. Whereas the rich, with their leveraged companies, are now the principal debtors. This is the democratization of finance argument, and it's nothing new. Whenever there are some people calling for the elimination of the class that lives by collecting interest, there will be others to object that this will destroy the livelihood of widows and pensioners. The remarkable thing is that nowadays, defenders of the financial system are often prepared to use both arguments, appealing to one or the other according to the rhetorical convenience of the moment. On the one hand, we have pundits like Thomas Friedman celebrating the fact that everyone now owns a piece of Exxon or Mexico, and that rich debtors are therefore answerable to the poor. On the other, Niall Ferguson, author of The Ascent of Money, published in 2009, can still announce as one of his major discoveries that, quote, Poverty is not the result of rapacious financiers exploiting the poor. It has much more to do with the lack of financial institutions, with the absence of banks, not their presence. Only when borrowers have sufficient access to efficient credit networks can they escape from the clutches of loan sharks. And only when savers can deposit their money in reliable banks can it be channeled from the idle rich to the industrious poor. Unquote. Such is the state of the conversation in the mainstream literature. My purpose here has been less to engage with it directly than to show how it has consistently encouraged us to ask the wrong questions. Let's take this last paragraph as an illustration. What's Ferguson really saying here? Poverty is caused by a lack of credit. It's only if the industrious poor have access to loans from stable, respectable banks, rather than to loan sharks or presumably credit card companies or payday loan operations, which now charge loan shark rates, that they can rise out of poverty. So actually, Ferguson is not really concerned with poverty at all, just with the poverty of some people. Those who are industrious and thus do not deserve to be poor. What about the non-industrious poor? They can go to hell, presumably, quite literally, according to many branches of Christianity. Or maybe their boats will be lifted somewhat by the rising tide. Still, that's clearly incidental. They're undeserving, since they're not industrious. And therefore, what happens to them is really beside the point. For me, this is exactly what is so pernicious about the morality of debt, the way that financial imperatives constantly try to reduce us all, despite ourselves, to the equivalent of pillagers, eyeing the world simply for what can be turned into money, and then tell us that it's only those who are willing to see the world as pillagers who deserve access to the resources required to pursue anything in life other than money. It introduces moral perversions on almost every level. Cancel all student loan debt? But that would be unfair to all those people who struggled for years to pay back their student loans. Let me assure the reader that, as somebody who struggled for years to pay back his student loans, and finally did so, this argument makes about as much sense as saying that it would be unfair to a mugging victim not to mug their neighbours too. The argument might perhaps make sense if one agreed with the underlying assumption that work is by definition virtuous, since the ultimate measure of humanity's success as a species is its ability to increase the overall global output of goods and services by at least 5% per year. The problem is that it's becoming increasingly obvious that if we continue along these lines much longer, we're likely to destroy everything. That giant debt machine that has, for the last 5 centuries, reduced increasing proportions of the world's population to the moral equivalent of conquistadors, would appear to be coming up against its social and ecological limits. Capitalism's inveterate propensity to imagine its own destruction has morphed, in the last half century, into scenarios that threaten to bring the rest of the world down with it. And there's no reason to believe that this propensity is ever going to go away. The real question now is how to ratchet things down a bit, to move toward a society where people can live more by working less. I'd like, then, to end by putting in a good word for the non-industrious poor. At least they aren't hurting anyone. Insofar as the time they're taking off work is being spent with friends and family, enjoying and caring for those they love, they're probably improving the world more than we acknowledge. Maybe we should think of them as pioneers of a new economic order that would not share our current one's penchant for self-destruction. In this book, I've largely avoided making concrete proposals, but let me end with one. It seems to me that we are long overdue for some kind of biblical-style jubilee, one that would affect both international debt and consumer debt. It would be salutary, not just because it would relieve so much genuine human suffering, but also because it would be our way of reminding ourselves that money is not ineffable, that paying one's debts is not the essence of morality, that all these things are human arrangements, and that if democracy is to mean anything, it is the ability to all agree to arrange things in a different way. It is significant, I think, that since Hammurabi, great imperial states have invariably resisted this kind of politics. Athens and Rome established the paradigm. Even when confronted with continual debt crises, they insisted on legislating around the edges, softening the impact, eliminating obvious abuses like debt slavery, using the spoils of empire to throw all sorts of extra benefits at their poorer citizens, who, after all, provided the rank and file of their armies, so as to keep them more or less afloat, but all in such a way as never to allow a challenge to the principle of debt itself. The governing class of the United States seems to have taken a remarkably similar approach, eliminating the worst abuses, e.g. debtors' prisons, using the fruits of empire to provide subsidies, visible and otherwise, to the bulk of the population, in the more recent years manipulating currency rates to flood the country with cheap goods from China, never allowing anyone to question the sacred principle that we must all pay our debts. At this point, however, the principle has been exposed as a flagrant lie. As it turns out, we don't all have to pay our debts. Only some of us do. Nothing would be more important than to wipe the slate clean for everyone, mark a break with our accustomed morality, and start again. What is a debt, anyway? A debt is just the perversion of a promise. It's a promise corrupted by both math and violence. If freedom, real freedom, is the ability to make friends, then it's also, necessarily, the ability to make real promises. What sorts of promises might genuinely free men and women make to one another? At this point, we can't even say. It's more a question of how can we get to a place that will allow us to find out? And the first step in that journey, in turn, is to accept that in the largest scheme of things, just as no one has the right to tell us our true value, no one has the right to tell us what we truly owe.
And that is the conclusion of David Graeber's Debt, the first 5,000 years. The PDF and the MP3 audiobook are available for download from our website. I think we'll take a break from money. We've had a lot of shows on that recently, but we're going to bear those lessons in mind, in particular the fact that morality should not be telescoped into anything financial. The way I see the world, reality, may have ideas of right and wrong, but they are not one-dimensional. They are not subject to mathematical laws. Things go very wrong when people sublimate feelings, ideas, emotions, and relationships, and focus on the numbers game. That is money. And that seems to be one of the main themes in the following documentary from the series Pandora's Box about technological rationalism. This is The League of Gentlemen, which focuses on Margaret Thatcher's monetary policy and the way in which politicians were attracted to ideas of being in charge of regulating the system, and the way in which time and time again turned out that they weren't in charge and that they couldn't be in charge. Now, this is adapted from a video which I shall link in from our website, unwelcomeguest.net/629. So if you have fast internet available, you may wish to download it and watch.
For the last 30 years, politicians in Britain have tried to build a new prosperity. They wanted to make an old nation that had fallen behind in the world recapture the glories of its past. They turned for help to what they believed was a science of money. One after another, Labour and Conservative governments became convinced that if they followed what they thought were a set of scientific laws, the economy would grow faster. The perceived tide of decline could be reversed. But instead of restoring the country's fortunes, the economic experiments failed to halt Britain's relative decline. This is the odd story of how politicians came to believe there was a technical way to make Britain great again.
Years ago, one car in every three bought in Sweden was British. Today, we've less than 10%.
Now that's a sad story, but let's take a quick sample here on this bridge in central Stockholm and see just what the Swedes are driving. Well, there's a Swedish Volvo, a Swedish Saab, that is another Swedish Volvo over there, a Swedish Volvo.
Michael Posner, economist.
One after another, other European countries who we were used to thinking of nice guys, but poorer, began to get within shouting distance of us and passing. It's like being in a sailing race and seeing people you didn't think were good enough or hadn't scraped the bottoms of their boat well enough, nevertheless overhauling you.
A German Ford truck, an English Zephyr, congratulations Ford, a Mercedes-Benz.
People began insistently to ask if they can once get on a growth path of that steepness. Won't they soon overtake us properly?
And a Volkswagen. Well, in that lot, one British car, one Ford.
What was holding Britain back, it was decided, was the old-fashioned idea that the civil servant's job was simply to keep the economy stable. In 1961, the Conservative government set up NEDI, the National Economic Development Council, in what had been a gentleman's club in Westminster. It was advised by young economists convinced they could make the economy grow much faster.
Sir Donald MacDougall, economic director of NEDC from 1962 to 64.
Ah, yes, this is my old room, a splendid room, isn't it? Yes. I'm sorry it's all boarded up, the windows there, because, you know, there's a balcony out there. As you know, the growth target of NEDI was 4% a year between 1961 and 1966. And I had visions of myself getting out onto that balcony and at the end of 1966 proclaiming to the cheering crowds below, 4%, we've done it.
Many of this generation of economists had been taught with the aid of a large machine worked by water. Built by Bill Phillips, an engineer turned economist, it has lain disused for years.
That powers these two...
Colin Carter.
...parts over here, which is where money can actually come into the economy. The actual water flowing around is the money going through the economy.
That enabled you to illustrate, for instance...
Reza Moghaddam from the London School of Economics.
What would happen if you try to grow the economy, pump more money into the economy? For instance, you could increase government expenditure and see what the effect of that is through the workings of the economy, the interaction of all the variables on growth. Of course, if the economy is very prone to imports, people might simply spend their money to import foreign goods. Or, if the economy is operating at a high level of activity, then that would lead to inflation.
NEDI's economists did not have a new theory, but they believed they could use existing techniques in a new way. They saw themselves as followers of the economist Maynard Keynes. He had shown how to manage an economy by increasing or decreasing demand. The problem was that every time you increased demand too much, imports flooded in and wages rose. But NEDI's economists were convinced they could control a boom. They would plan investment in industry and the government would hold inflation down. The bad old days of stop-go would be over.
1%, 1%, and what are we to fear? A lousy little 1% and paradise is here.
With George Mulder, Chancellor of Exchequer, 1963.
Our plans for the future of Britain in the coming year are clear and comprehensive. We have accepted with enthusiasm the NEDI target of a 4% growth rate, and all our actions have been designed to achieve it. This nation must not jog along. This nation must be inspired with the determination to achieve great things.
Factory owner called his men and said, I'm confident you'll rally to the challenge and produce that 1%. And up then spoke a worker,
do our wages rise or what?
And the boss said, most amusing, and sacked him on the spot.
By 1963, the economists' promises seemed to be coming true. The Conservatives had poured money into the economy, and sure enough, it had begun to grow.
they had placed their bets on growth. They talked about it a lot. There was an announcement about it, white papers, speeches, and all the rest. In our system of politics, when something important like that is put on the table by the government of the day, the opposition has to respond to it.
Party political broadcast on behalf of the Labour Party, 1964.
My purpose tonight is to have a word with you about the future of Britain. The outstanding thing we ought to do, obviously, is to get up our economic strength, operating a national plan, a plan for steady, continuous, controlled production and expansion.
Labour promised a national plan, run by a separate Department of Economic Affairs under George Brown. It would make Britain grow by a quarter in just 6 years. It was a seductive dream for a socialist party, for if the economists could produce this growth, then Labour's leaders would avoid what they had always thought inevitable, the battle to redistribute the country's wealth. Instead, there would be more for everyone. But it all depended on the economists' promises that they had the technical solutions to the politicians' problems.
Professor Charles Goodhart, economic advisor to the Department of Economic Affairs, 1965-67.
We saw ourselves as providing the politicians with a potential menu of outcomes, but if the politicians would give us some indication, then we could set the instruments in such a way as we could deliver reasonably enough, give or take the various shocks that would occur in the economy, the kind of outcomes that the politicians wanted.
There's one basic fact. Labour has a clear majority. We have a Labour government.
But Labour had come to power just as the boom the Conservatives had begun was overheating. Imports were flooding in and wages rising. This was the point when in the past a halt would have been called. But Labour were determined to press on.
Mr. Brown. Have you been discussing the economic situation this morning?
We've been discussing the affairs...
Labour had missed out a vital component from the plan, the economists told them. They should devalue the pound and so make Britain's exports cheaper. But in the politicians' eyes, devaluation would undermine precisely what they were trying to achieve.
Sir Donald MacDougall, Director General of the Department of Economic Affairs, 1964-68.
To make Britain great again.
Wilson was a great one who believed in sterling. Sterling was the centre of everything. And he always said that he would defend the pound and we'd have a place east of Suez. And it was a sort of nationalism of a kind.
After that, all talk of devaluation by economists and everyone else was forbidden. I personally used to do little sums on scraps of paper in my room in the DEA. When anyone opened the door, I would hastily put them into my drawer.
There are millions of workers in this country who will never get fair play until you've got a decent incomes policy. Can't you get that into your head?
By 1965, the boom was clearly out of control. Faced with inflation, the government tried to hold down wages and prices, but to no avail. It also faced repeated runs on the pound, as foreign investors lost confidence in Labour's management of the economy. Now became a game between the politicians whose fortunes depended on it and their economists, who had begun to realise the economy was now far beyond their control. They were being used.
Brian Redding, from the Department of Economic Affairs, 1964-66.
I think the moment I really realised it was a gimmick was when, after we'd finished work on it, and it was the summer, I think it was the summer of 1965, I hadn't very much to do, and so I decided I'd look at the details of the plan and see all the different measures, the things like the decision that you'd double expenditure on road building, for instance, and try and work out what effects these might have on the growth rate of the country. And I laboriously worked through, making my best guesses and calculations, not having been particularly told to do this by anybody, and came up with the results, and they were well, well short of anything that might have produced the 25% growth. And I wandered along to my seniors and said, hey, look, I've done this useful little exercise. And they weren't in the least interested. Nothing to do with it at all.
July 20th, 1966.
The fight for the pound is on. After last week's depressing trade figures and the rise in the bank rate, after a weekend of growing speculation and 3 days of shoring up the pound in the foreign exchange market, Mr. Harold Wilson himself cried stop.
What went wrong was that foreigners who held the pound decided in unison that Britain was no longer to be trusted. There was a wave, there was a mood. And what the government has done is to respond to the mood by producing something which demonstrates a will to deflate this economy, which is bound to crush it, in my view. In other words, we're condemned to no growth.
The attempt to plan growth had failed. Britain was left with little expansion and political disaster. Most economists blamed it on the government's failure to devalue. Few asked whether the weakness of Britain's currency was really a symptom of something much deeper, far beyond the power of their techniques to deal with. A year later, the government bowed to the inevitable and devalued. But it was far too late. The economy had long ago come juddering to a stop.
Michael Posner, Economic Advisor to the Treasury, 1966-67.
As a result of that experience, we had to abandon the notion, tacitly and slowly, but abandon it all the same, that the planning apparatus itself was the unique and certain method of achieving the aim of faster growth. We still believed in faster growth, and we still, many of us, thought that it was attainable, but this particular path to its achievement was no longer key, was no longer essential, could no longer be relied upon.
In the early 70s, many economists began to find they no longer understood how money behaved. The new Conservative government under Edward Heath had tried what was called a dash for growth. They poured in money by liberalizing credit and increasing public spending. For a moment, the economy boomed. But then the strangest thing happened. Prices and unemployment began to rise together. People called it stagflation.
All a girl needs.
30p for a deck chair this week. Blimey, it was only 15p last week. This inflation's killing me.
Professor Alan Budd, Economic Advisor to the Treasury, 1970-1974. Interviewed in 1991 when advisor to Barclays Bank.
Now, I happened to arrive in the Treasury in 1970. When I got there, people really felt that they didn't quite understand how the economy worked anymore. And one particular example of this was that we saw unemployment and inflation rising at the same time. And that was something that should have been quite impossible. And while this was going on, they're sitting in Chicago in the States with the monetarists who said, no, we know perfectly well what's going on. We can explain it. You've been led astray by your Keynesian beliefs. And we can explain precisely what's going on. And it's all to do with the growth of the money supply.
Professor Milton Friedman, monetarist economist.
I and people who believe the way that we did were saying that a continuation of the policies was going to lead to higher inflation and more unemployment. It represented a recognition that fine efforts to produce paradise on earth were producing something very different than what was intended.
Friedman argued that any attempt to put money into the economy to make it grow was doomed to failure. But he was not challenging the idea of the economy as a predictable system, only how it worked. He considered his laws were as powerful and objective as those of the physical sciences.
It was scientific. Inflation is not a communist phenomenon. It's not a capitalist phenomenon. It's a printing press phenomenon. That's a scientific statement. And you will only have inflation if the quantity of money increases more rapidly than output. You can only stop inflation by slowing down the rate of monetary growth.
Monetarism offered an attractive technical explanation for the problem of inflation. But from it would come in less than 10 years another scheme for Britain's salvation. A set of scientific rules which, if the politicians followed them correctly, would create the right conditions for economic growth. It began with a disillusioned group of economists. They included two influential journalists, Peter Jay of The Times and Sam Britton of The Financial Times.
Sam Britton.
We were found to be stimulating and interesting, which are the English words for damning people. And we were always regarded as good for a puzzling interlude in a programme such as this.
The Money Programme, 1972.
of a complete runaway inflation and an internal collapse of confidence in
the currency. I think, Mr. Britton, that that's an exaggeration when you start talking about runaway inflation in Germany after the First World War. I think, quite frankly, that that's an exaggeration that can't be sustained by anyone.
But I think
can we stay on our home ground for the moment?
Yes. If there was one place where we tended to bump into each other, it was the Institute of Economic Affairs.
Lord Harris of Highcross, President of the Institute of Economic Affairs.
Milton Friedman would set up a table here to maximise the array of people that we could fit in. We could probably fit in 20 or 25 people in this small room, and he would develop his argument briefly, very emphatically, in strong form, and he would say, if you want details of this and particular episodes in American history, I can go back to that, and then the discussion would take place.
Professor Alan Budd, economic advisor to the Treasury.
To start with, I must admit, I didn't believe the monetarists for a moment. This seemed totally implausible. This was the sort of economics that I'd been told to discard for all the time I'd been learning economics. It was a joke, really. It wasn't to be taken seriously. Whatever else one used to explain inflation, it wasn't the money supply.
In February of 1974, Edward Heath's government fell. Amid power cuts, a three-day week, and never-ending inflation. They were direct consequences of his crude dash for growth. The time was ripe for the monetarists, in particular Alan Walters, a professor from the London School of Economics. He began to attract both press and politicians with apocalyptic warnings of what was to come.
July 1974.
A reduction in output, an increase in unemployment, and at the same time, rampant inflation. Inflation of the order of perhaps 30%, perhaps even increasing as we go on. There is a real danger of hyperinflation.
Lord Joseph, member of the Conservative Cabinet, 1970 to 74.
Alan Walters had snubbed me when I went back to meet old friends. Once the government fell and I was back in, I was back as a member of parliament without a government post. And Alan Walters refused to shake my hand. He said, "You've been debauching the currency. Why should I welcome you back?" And I started to rethink what we'd been up to. And a fellow called Alfred Sherman was very influential in convincing me. He used to say, "Don't you know, Keynes is dead, Keynes is dead." I didn't understand what he meant.
Sir Alfred Sherman.
He turned to me for help. And I managed to persuade him to go further and look at the whole Keynesian mumbo-jumbo, the panacea.
Keith Joseph toured the country, translating monetarism into a political programme. The primary job of economics was no longer to create employment, he said. It was to reduce inflation.
After having failed to persuade the shadow cabinet to reconsider our economic policies, I warned them that I'd have to make a speech. Well, the speech was made. I remember that I said to Sam Britton, who looked at one of the drafts, "This speech has been through 9 drafts. We're trying to get it right." And Alfred Sherman from the background said, "Yes," and I wrote 13 of them. Well, we slogged at that speech.
"Is threatening to destroy our society. The distress and unemployment that will follow unless the trend is stopped will be catastrophic. Inflation is caused by spending more than we produce, too much money, chasing too few goods, deficit financing, printing money. Mild inflation seemed a painless way of maintaining full employment, encouraging growth, and expanding the social services. We now see that inflation has turned out to be a mortal threat to all three."
1975.
But Labour was in power. As before, they had inherited the chaos of a Conservative boom. Yet this time, none of the traditional Keynesian methods offered them any help, because inflation and unemployment were rising together. It was something the Keynesians believed impossible. By the end of 1975, the economists advising the government were lost.
Gordon Pepper, City stockbroker, 1962 to 1990.
My memory is, I think it was a dinner party I'd deliberately organised, where the main economic modellers were there. The Treasury was represented, the Bank was represented, the National Institute of Economic and Social Research, London Business School. I was a fly on the wall, and they were talking about the medium-term projections in their models. And they were unanimous that they could not project what was going to happen to inflation or to unemployment or the balance of payments. There's almost total agreement around the room that the UK was in serious danger of going to absolute decline, that was negative growth, not just growing at a slower rate than other industrialised countries. That is when the civil servants in the Treasury and the Bank of England realised that the UK economy had arrived at the brink of the abyss. They had sight of the awfulness of what that abyss might look like, and they were shell-shocked as a result of it.
Then, in March 1976, Britain fell into the abyss.
2025.
Foreign investors, led by American bankers, panicked. The pound began to slide against the dollar, and nothing would stop it.
Sorry?
It dropped
2025
and
stocky. 1025,
stocky.
Yeah, no, it dropped 100 points. We don't know why. It just dropped 100 points when everything else was staying sturdy.
Britain faced bankruptcy. In desperation, Labour turned to the International Monetary Fund for a loan. An IMF team came to London. They were determined that the only way to restore confidence was for the British government to adopt monetarist policies. In a speech that could have been written by Keith Joseph, Prime Minister James Callaghan told the Labour Party why it had to do what the financial markets wanted.
Labour Party Conference, September 1976.
We used to think that you could use spend your way out of a recession and increase employment by cutting taxes and boosting government spending. I tell you in all candour that that option no longer exists, and that insofar as it ever did exist, it only worked on each occasion since the war by injecting a bigger dose of inflation into the economy on every occasion, followed by a higher level of unemployment as the next step.
The Right Honourable Tony Benn, Member of the Labour Cabinet, 1976.
It was presented scientifically, but then they always present it scientifically as being the only way of doing it. There is no alternative. And this gripped people. But at the same time, you must never forget that politics is in the pursuit of an interest and an ideology. And if the scientist helps you with the ideology, you use him. If he doesn't, you disregard him. So the conflict between, as it were, Milton Friedman and Keynes was a political conflict. It wasn't really that it was people solemnly assessing the different values of two sets of ideas. One benefited one group, another benefited another.
In December 1976, the IMF granted a loan to Britain. That same month, Milton Friedman was awarded the Nobel Prize. In just 5 years, his economic theory had moved from the margins to centre stage. It was seen by many politicians as the only solution to Britain's disastrous economic position. And waiting in the wings was Friedman's most devoted follower, a politician who believed it was possible to use monetarism as the basis of a plan to regenerate the country.
1978.
Keith Joseph was now the closest advisor to the new leader of the Tory Party, Margaret Thatcher. He and the economists around him had drawn up what was called the medium-term financial strategy.
The boss. The boss.
Coffee, and then they want us all out. Angus, hello, in you go. Any particular? I'll bring you all out in a moment.
The plan was to combine monetarism with another theory from economics called rational expectations. It said that whenever a government changes policy, it will only work if the politicians can persuade people they are going to stick with it, whatever happens.
We believe that in announcing and publishing a mid-term financial strategy of what we were going to do with the crucial element of the money supply, we would persuade the negotiators, the managements and the trade unions, and the opinion formers that there must be some limit to pay claims if jobs were not to be priced out of the market. Rational expectation.
It was to get away from short-termism. And in that respect, it had something in common with the National Plan, a comparison of which I'm not ashamed.
And as with the National Plan, it was all very simple. The supply of money was to be reduced by raising interest rates and cutting public spending. Inflation would fall and enterprise flourish. Instead of putting money in, as Labour had done 15 years before, this time the theory said it should be tightly controlled.
Monetarism worked throughout the 19th century when we were the envy of the world, with our people growing in numbers and generally prospering, generally, despite all the horrors of the time, generally prospering, with the world looking to us for how to do it. It could work again. There arose a slightly messianic sense of mission.
May 1979.
Haven't you heard of inflation?
I tell you what I want to see.
What's that?
Labour in power again.
Labour in power? Was that the Marx Brothers?
Nah, another bunch of comedians.
Coming shortly, the Conservatives.
I can't bear Britain in decline. I just can't. We who either defeated or rescued half Europe, who kept half Europe free, when otherwise it would be in chains. And look at us now.
Milton Friedman interviewed in October 1979.
The Thatcher government is a kind of an experiment in whether it will be possible in a democratic society that has gone as far as Britain has gone to change course in an orderly, effective way to set Britain on a new road. If the Thatcher government succeeds, it will be an example that will not be lost on the United States or the rest of the world.
The latest unemployed from the Royal Stafford helped form an unwelcoming committee for Mrs. Thatcher as she arrived at the
But
Royal
the economy did not behave in the way the monetarists predicted. The squeeze on money led to a wave of factory closures, while inflation continued to rise.
Which factory closed?
A small one, which suffered from lack of investment, among other things.
Roy Adkin, insolvency practitioner in the West Midlands.
I've been in insolvency for all my professional life, and I think up until 1980, I used to go in with a great deal of confidence that with new management and perhaps some sort of reorganisation, something could be done. It was very sad to have to go onto the shop floor in the early 80s into a company knowing, in fact, that there wasn't much chance of selling that business, and that, in fact, the business would come to an end.
This is what would normally be a working day. It's the middle of the week. And we're now down in this plant, which produces well over half the cast iron baths of the United Kingdom, onto 1 week on, 1 week off. And that's an immediate and practical effect of the strict monetarism policy that the government is carrying out.
The managing director said, I'm very sorry to tell you, but as from this minute, the firm has gone into voluntary liquorisation. That was it.
Somebody shouted, will we get any wages? And he said, you'll get nothing.
There now follows a government statement on the current employment figures.
1980.
Oh, dear.
The government seems to have totally lost its way in terms of the interaction of four economic indicators on British industry.
Oh, God.
As every member of any firm knows, once with high interest rates as a weapon for controlling money supply, what is the first thing that has to be cut? Investment. Because you still have to pay wages and you still have to pay your current costs.
One day we may be able to afford it. I get the economic policies right.
The government would say, just hang on and stop making such a fuss now.
Yeah, all I can say is that the government isn't standing where I'm bloody well standing.
Even more mystifying was the behaviour of the money supply. Despite the squeeze, it was still growing, something the monetarists thought impossible.
Professor Charles Goodhart, Chief Economic Advisor on Monetary Policy to the Bank of England, 1980-85.
Well, it was all a bit embarrassing. People like me who were at the Bank of England, because we'd been forced, you know, the government had signed up for this path of gently declining monetary aggregates, and instead of the monetary aggregates gently declining, some 5 or 6 months after this new policy was put into operation, they took an enormous jump, and it was very difficult to know why or to know what ought to be done about it.
By the end of 1980, unemployment had nearly doubled. Manufacturing output had fallen by a sixth. Britain was declining faster than even in the darkest days of the 1930s. Despite this, the politicians were convinced they were right. The laws of their science told them so.
Let me just have a word about monetarism and monetary control first. I mean, you all know full well that if you produce too much of something, its value will fall. That's elementary.
It isn't a newfangled theory. It is as essential as the law of gravity, and you can't avoid it.
Lord Joseph, Secretary of State for Industry, 1979-81.
People used to say, you're destroying my job, and I was absolutely secure in my conscience that their negotiators and their employers were destroying their jobs by not following rational expectations and seeing that if they didn't accommodate unit labour costs by a combination of pay increases allowed and rising productivity to what would keep their prices internationally competitive, jobs would go. So there was I, absolutely clear in my conscience, and there were they convinced in their what I would call invincible ignorance that I was an enemy. Yes, it was awkward time.
Sir John Hoskins, Chief Policy Advisor to Margaret Thatcher, 1979-82.
There's no question that what was happening did, in my view, a great deal of damage to the economy. The politicians of the day will never admit to that. They never admit to making mistakes at all. But it's quite clear that's what was happening. They were trying to do it right, but they got it wrong.
In January 1981, Alan Walters became Mrs. Thatcher's economic advisor. Although a convinced monetarist, he agreed with Sir John Hoskins that interest rates would have to come down. This in turn would reduce the exchange rate and make exports more competitive. But the problem was how to do it without admitting that all the destruction of the past 2 years had been for nothing. The only solution, they said, was to cut even more from public spending. That way the government would be seen to be keeping up its squeeze on the money supply.
What we said was, we will take a deep breath and take an enormous amount of money out of the economy, but at the nadir of a major recession. I mean, it's against every textbook that's ever been written or all the Keynesian conventional wisdom which prevailed at the time. And thus, hopefully, by that insurance, make it very unlikely that we would have to put interest rates back up again just at the wrong moment. At a meeting with Mrs. Thatcher and Geoffrey Howe, they were both absolutely taken aback. I think they could hardly believe their ears. And then Mrs. Thatcher saying, very indignantly, you know, it's all very well for you, but you don't have to stand up and defend it in the House.
In the budget of 1981, public borrowing was cut by a fifth. 364 leading economists wrote to the Times and the Prime Minister, accusing her of virtually destroying the economy. That summer, there were riots in English cities that even some cabinet members blamed on the economic policy. Unemployment headed towards 2.5 million. Inflation did begin to fall, but the money supply continued its mysterious rise. It became clear that the fundamental law of monetarism, the relationship between the money supply and inflation, didn't work. Ever so quietly, this solution to Britain's problems was discarded. Finally, the man who had first brought the monetarist message to Britain was publicly told it was over.
A Week in Politics, February 1985.
Monetarist economists believe in something called the natural rate of unemployment, which is supposed to be the rate at which inflation stops or ceases to accelerate. Now, do you think that we, Prime Minister, with all-time record unemployment figures this week, have yet reached that natural rate, even though inflation is still proceeding sufficiently to halve the value of money every 15 years?
It's not a doctrine to which I've ever subscribed. It's one which I think actually came in with Milton Friedman. I used to read about it, I used to look about it. It's not a doctrine. It's a theory to which I've never subscribed.
Some of those who had lived through the experiment now became deeply pessimistic. One economist saw it as proof that it was fundamentally impossible to change, in a predictable way, how an economy behaved. As in other sciences, his observation had a formal name, Goodhart's Law.
Professor Charles Goodhart.
Goodhart's Law said that if ever the government decides to rely on any particular statistical relationship as a basis for policy, as soon as it did that, that relationship would fall apart. And that's just what happened. The implication is that what you should try and do is not to disturb things too much and let individual agents go on and try and make the best of the situation as each of them sees it individually.
I beg your pardon. Whatever promised you, Rose Garden.
It was a conclusion that fitted well with conservative philosophy. If there was nothing that governments could do, then the economic agents in a newly liberated city of London should be left alone. Unlike the economists, they seem to know how money worked.
1986.
The city's growing confidence and drive owes a good deal to young people. Its vast new dealing rooms are run by the young. People who made it not because of who they know or what school tie they wear, but on sheer merit, and that is the kind of society I want to see.
Brian Winterflood, Economic Director, County NatWest Securities, 1986-88. Interviewed walking around a rather desolate-looking office.
Capital was available, ideas were available, and there was a keenness to do things. And I think that probably the government felt that our merchant bankers and the City of London, which after all had put us on the map, there they were again, they were to go out and they were going to make us great again, if you like.
Money now became a commodity traded for itself. It was managed by young technicians in the dealing rooms. Economists who once thought they could control money became its servants. They were now employed in their hundreds by the banks to predict on television what might or might not happen as a result of the colossal flows of capital.
What do you see?
It is, of course, extremely uncertain, but my view is that...
Well, I guess there's still a lot more to come. We're currently saying
people fear that there will be a rerun of what happened a fortnight ago.
I suspect it'll certainly not stop.
There is, however, a risk that interest rates will have to go higher.
It may even get worse.
Sir Alfred Sherman.
When you get a loss of faith, say if bishops cease to believe in God, they're going for socialism or sodomy. But an economist who's agnostic about economics is unemployable. Therefore, they said, we know if you do this and if you do that. And the economists will argue with each other, but none of them will ever question whether economics is as scientific as it claims.
Great, Great Britain, the finest country in the world, right? And let us not forget who made it Great Britain this last 8 years.
April 1987.
When I go to the Western Summit in Venice on Monday, I will go with my head held high as leader of a strong country.
Chief Inspector Ernie Plum, retired, of the City of London Police Force.
There were people earning a lot of money without doing anything at all in this world of money. Then it suddenly came to a dramatic halt in the 80s. The reasons I can't give you, you'll need to talk to a qualified economist, and no doubt they'll have differing views on why it happened. But the system overnight became much more cutthroat. We had examples of firms right out of the blue calling fire drills, locking their employees out, and throwing their belongings from the window to them, and saying, sorry chaps, you're fired. That's how bad things became.
The bubble burst again. But that's what happens in history. You'll have these slumps and these booms, and you won't change it, because that's what capitalism is really, isn't it?
Richard Turton, partner in the insolvency department of Touche Ross.
I don't think we can change the world. It's not something we can do. Certainly we insolvency specialists can't. Our job is sweeping up or trying to prevent. Now, as far as I can see, the best way is to try and see whether we can do something about stopping people being greedy and stopping people being overambitious. And I don't think you ever will do that.
I mean, the economists seem to think that the whole of the problems can be solved by money, by the use of money rather than the creation of wealth. But they've never really got anywhere near it. So I would ask the question, whose money? What money? Where's it coming from?
10 years ago, Britain was a loser. Today, Britain
rather haunting imagery of disused factories.
Is the party over?
Yes, Bunny, the party's over. The drink and the luck ran out.
Economics has really obscured the fundamental problems of the British economy by seeming to be able to give a particular solution by pulling a particular lever or pulling a set of levers. It's obscured the longer term decline in our industries, the longer term decline in the quality of our labour force, which politicians should really have been addressing 30 or 40 years ago, and which some of our European competitors, who've turned out far fewer economists in Britain, by the way, have succeeded in doing much better than we have in the UK.
For some economists who were involved in this story, there is a further question. were their theories used to disguise political policies that would otherwise have been very difficult to implement in Britain?
Professor Alan Budd, economic advisor to the Treasury, 1970-74, interviewed in 1991 when advisor to Barclays Bank.
The nightmare I sometimes have about this whole experience runs as follows. I was involved in making a number of proposals which were partly at least adopted by the government and put in play by the government. Now, my worry is as follows, that there may have been people making the actual policy decisions, or people behind them, who never believed for a moment that this was the correct way to bring down inflation. They did, however, see that it would be a very, very good way to raise unemployment. And raising unemployment was an extremely desirable way of reducing the strength of the working classes, if you like, that what was engineered there, in Marx's terms, was a crisis of capitalism which recreated the reserve army of labour and has allowed the capitalists to make high profits ever since. Now, again, I don't say I believe that story, but when I really worry about all this, I worry whether, indeed, that was really what was going on.
What we now doubt, which we used to think, was that our models will enable us to look into the future and indeed to change the future to the benefit of mankind. The experience of recent years has been such that as soon as we develop a model that seems to be reasonably good at explaining the present, and there are few enough of those, God knows now, the future changes.
We live in an imperfect world, and if that's true, how are you ever going to make it a better world?
We can perhaps hope that we can prevent it becoming a worse world. I don't think that we can easily make it a better world.
Yeah, that's a forbidden truth that I agree with. If you're not an economist, I don't think it's so hard to improve the world. I don't see that the world has to be governed by a small number of people making the decisions for other people. I think Alan Budd is the star of this show with his observation that, self-defeating or not, mendacious or not, the policies pursued by the Thatcher regime did serve certain people's interests. Is it just coincidence that Margaret Thatcher was invited to the Bilderberg Group before she became Prime Minister? The biggest single, Forbidden Truth, to me, even more fundamental than the decoupling of money with morality, is the fundamental truth that people do not need money. Tough for many of us to swallow, seems to contradict a lot of experience, and I think economists in general will be the last to admit it. Their credo, of course, says yes, money is essential, healthy climate, breathable atmosphere, the real world, in short, is secondary phenomenon. And I think reality's going to have the last laugh on this one. And the sooner humanity wakes up to that, the better. Our theme music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can. Don't see things in money terms. Isn't the real world enough without attaching numbers? Another brain.